Imagine how Leonard feels with two brothers gone like that. Stubby, he was your father's great uncle. He slept on that twin bed in the hallway. He was small, so he fit. You remember him? He always pinched your face and made you mad. One time when you were three, you called him a Japanese sniper. You were just trying to get him back for pinching you, but Stubby really did look Japanese. Lizzie B., your father's grandmother, she slept in an army cot in the kitchen. She had arthritis bad, so she liked to sleep near that wood stove. We didn't have enough wood to keep the fire going every night, but it would stay warm for a while. She used to give you dollar bills. You saved them all in an old coffee tin. You hid that tin in the rocks behind the house. Somebody found it, though, and stole your money. It was probably one of the attic boys who stole it. But it could have been your dad, too. He was drinking a lot when we lived in that old house. Your big sister, Mary, when she wasn't living with her father in Montana or running around with some boy, she would sleep on the couch in the living room. Your little sisters, the twins, they shared a crib in the bedroom. Your dad and I slept in the bed. When Mary was home, you slept on the floor beside our bed. If she was gone, you slept on the couch. Sometimes, though, when you knew Mary was getting ready to leave again, you'd sleep on the floor by the couch. And then you'd cry for days after she was gone. Your big brother, he slept in the bedroom closet. He was too big for it. He had to sleep curled up like a dog. He always liked to sleep in places that squeezed him. I don't know why. And oh, you had those night terrors when you were little. You'd wake up screaming and shake the whole house. And yeah, we didn't have indoor plumbing until 72. You remember the outhouse? It wasn't too bad to use in daytime or in good weather, but it was pretty rugged if it was winter and 3 in the morning. Do you remember how I caught you peeing out the window one night? Yeah, you said your dad had taught you how to pee that way so you didn't have to go to the outhouse in the dark. And then a few days later, I found a bunch of pee stains in the snow under the window, and I asked you about it, and you blamed your sisters. That was so funny. You didn't even know your sisters had different anatomy and couldn't have balanced on the windowsill and peed that far. And then that old house burned down. Do you remember that? Yeah. I was sorry about leaving that old house. And I was happy when we moved into the new HUD house. But I love that old house, too. Remember the pharmacist at the clinic? The white guy? French name, I think. Very handsome? He took a photo of the old house burning, but there was this optical illusion that made it look like the new house was burning, too? Yeah. Two house fires at the same time. That was us. 10 days after our mother was diagnosed with Parkinson's, we learned that she was also afflicted with small cell lung cancer. Terminal cancer, the doctor said. She had only weeks to live. She had not smoked since she'd stopped drinking, but our father had puffed on cigars for decades. Can cigar smoke cause small cell lung cancer? Yes. Can secondhand cigar smoke cause small cell lung cancer? Yes. In 1987, while a senior in high school, my future college girlfriend, a white woman, measured radon levels in various reservation houses as part of a science project. Our HUD house had moderately dangerous levels of radon, a colorless, odorless, tasteless, and radioactive noble gas. Can radon cause small cell lung cancer? Yes. My reservation is also home to 2 closed uranium mines and a closed uranium mill. One mine, the Sherwood, operated for only a few years and was shut down and cleaned with award-winning thoroughness. The other mine, Midnight, which operated from 1955 to 1981, was simply abandoned and never made safe on any level. Can uranium cause cancer? Yes, especially when inhaled as dust. Gated, barbed-wired, the 350-acre Midnight Mine is now dotted with massive mounds of radioactive waste rock and ore, over 30 million tons in total, and uncounted barrels of various and mysterious chemicals. For years, huge trucks hauled uranium ore through Welpinit, passing less than a mile from my childhood home, on their way to the uranium mill located on the east side of the reservation. I remember those trucks shedding small rocks and dust as they rumbled past us Indian kids walking, running, and riding our bicycles. Many driveways and roads on our reservation were paved with those waste rocks. Located only 6 miles from my childhood HUD house, the mine also contains massive covered and uncovered pits, some more than 500 feet deep, that are filled with impossibly green and blue wastewater. According to the Environmental Protection Agency, the flora, fauna, and groundwater near the Midnight Mine are unsafe to eat and drink. That radioactive groundwater has, for decades, drained down the hillside into Blue Creek, which then flows into the Spokane River. There is a beach at that place where the radioactive creek merges with the radioactive river. Over the years, many Spokane Indians collected water and rocks from Blue Creek to use in our sacred sweat lodges. A sweat lodge is made by bending flexible wood branches into a dome shape that is draped with blankets and tarps. That flexible wood was sometimes collected from willows along Blue Creek. Other wood, like ponderosa pine, was sometimes gathered from trees felled near that mine. That wood was used to build campfires. Pots of Blue Creek's radioactive water were boiled on those campfires. Ladles of that water were poured onto the piles of radioactive rocks placed inside sweat lodges. That steam was meant to purify us. We sang and prayed in the superheated and closed spaces of our radioactive sweat lodges. During my childhood, Blue Creek Beach was also our family's favorite place to picnic, play in the sand, and swim. Unlike the rest of our family, my mother and I had always been terribly afraid of water. She and I had never learned how to swim. But when I close my eyes, I can see her walking barefoot through that beach sand. I can see her kicking dust into the air. I can see her step into the creek up to her ankles. I can see her wade into the river up to her knees. I can see her waving hello, 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 and goodbye. Chapter 3. The Call. In late June 2015, my sister called me. "You better get here," she said. "The doctor said Mom is near the end." "Okay," I said, "I'm on the way." My wife, Diane, and I and our teenage sons drove from Seattle to the reservation and made our way to my childhood home. As we pulled into the driveway, I saw my sister sitting on the front porch steps. "Oh, God," I said to my wife. "Mom must have died already. Arlene wants to tell me before I go inside the house." I hurried out of the car and ran to embrace my sister. "When did she die?" I asked. "Mom's not dead yet," my sister said. I was confused. I couldn't recall a single time when any Indian in my life had formally greeted me at their front door. "Then why were you waiting for us outside?" I asked. "I have to warn you," my sister said. "What?" I asked. "Is Mom deformed or something?" I couldn't imagine how lung cancer, how any cancer other than skin cancer, might dramatically change a person's appearance. "No," my sister said, "it's just, well, it's just..." She hesitated and covered her face with her hands. I thought she was crying, but then I realized she was laughing. "What?" I asked. "What's so funny?" "I wanted to warn you," she said. "I wanted to prepare you. You see, Mom is being affectionate. She's like hugging people and telling us she loves us. It's weird." My sister and I laughed together. We hugged again. And then we walked inside to greet my dying mother. Chapter 4. Good Hair. On her deathbed, my mother reached up and touched my face. She touched my hair. "Your hair is so curly," she said. "You have the curliest hair of any Indian ever." "My sons have curlier hair than me," I said. "Look at them." My mother looked at her grandsons and laughed. "Everybody is curly," she said. I said, "When Indians have curly hair, I call it the Geronifro." My mother laughed. "Don't cut your hair when I die," she said. When my father died, I sliced off my long hair and buried it in a secret place. "I don't have braids anymore," I said. "My hair is messy, but it's short." "Don't cut your curls," my mother said, "and don't let the boys cut their hair." "Okay," I said. "You should grow back your braids," she said. "Honor me by wearing your hair long again." "Okay," I said. I lied. Chapter 5. Soda Can. 1977, I was 10. My mother and I were arguing. I don't remember how the fight started. We, the bipolar mother and her bipolar son, fought so often that all of the arguments blended into a terrifying yet predictable ride. My mother and I were roller coaster cars on parallel tracks. During that argument in 1977, I remember the hatred I felt for my mother. It didn't feel like a temporary hatred, and it didn't feel like an adolescent rage. It felt like something more profound and permanent than youthful angst. My hatred felt as ancient as a cave painting. I didn't want to physically hurt my mother, but I certainly wanted my words to break her soul's back over my soul's knee. But as I screamed at her, and she screamed back, she kept working on the damn quilt in her lap. "I hate your quilts," I screamed. On the surface, those four words didn't seem all that bad. But my mother's quilting wasn't a hobby. Quilting was her philosophy. Fabric square ad infinitum. "I hate your quilts," I screamed again. "Shut up," she screamed. And then I called her the worst thing possible. I know what word you think I used. The worst epithet an American man can throw at an American woman. But I've never used that particular word during any heated moment and can't recall ever saying it in even the most ironic sense. Instead, I called her something that had become my greatest personal weapon against her. "Why don't you shut up?" I screamed. "You old bag!" Yes. My mother vehemently hated to be called an old bag. It's an unpleasant thing to say to anybody, let alone your mother. But it's a slur that could play on Nickelodeon TV. Why did my mother hate that curse more than any other? I suppose it had to do more with the force of the emotion behind the insult than the insult itself. But I must also note that a friend, after reading an early draft of this chapter, interpreted old bag as meaning used condom. I was shocked by his observation. Did my mother think that I was calling her a used condom? I doubt it, but I wonder about her definition of old bag. I'd always thought that I was just insulting her age and wrinkled skin and her existential emptiness. I wish I could ask my mother why she hated that particular insult so much. It makes me want to buy a Ouija board and ask her about the whole damn situation. Maybe her ghost would be honest with me. So yes, I'd insulted my mother's quilting and called her an old bag. She'd had enough of my disrespect. She reached over toward the end table, grabbed a mostly full can of Pepsi, and threw it at me. I stood by the back door. She sat on the couch. We were at least 15 feet apart. My mother did not have good hand-eye coordination. She was not athletic. And yet, as that Pepsi can flew toward me, seemingly in slow motion, I found myself thinking, shit, that thing is going to hit me in the face. I could have easily dodged the can, but I didn't. Instead, I watched it with amazement. I kept marveling that my extremely clumsy mother had thrown it with such force and accuracy. I worry now that I didn't duck because I wanted to get hit. In any case, I continued to be amazed and or expectant as that can struck me in the forehead and knocked me unconscious. Okay, I need to remind you that I was a hydrocephalic kid who had brain surgery at 5 months and then again at 2 years and suffered epileptic seizures until I was 7. I still have 4 burr hole soft spots in my skull and a Frankenstein mess of head scars. So yes, along with bipolar disorder, my brain damage might have also made me quick to rage. But let's get back to that soda can. It would be dangerous to throw that projectile at anybody's face, but it was especially threatening to me. I don't know how long I was unconscious. When I opened my eyes and looked at the water-stained ceiling, I was in shock. I wasn't bleeding very much, but would have a huge bruise, a black eye of the forehead, for a week. I slowly sat up and saw that my mother was still quilting. I don't know if she'd even moved from the couch after she'd knocked me out. Maybe she thought I was faking it. That's the only way to justify the fact that she hadn't sought to help me. I silently and slowly got to my feet. I was dizzy, nauseated, and confused. It felt like my arms and legs had switched places, and I would have to relearn how to walk again. There was no concussion protocol in those days. Carefully, I walked to the basement door, opened it, eased my way downstairs, shuffled to my room, slumped onto my bed, and slept for many dreamless hours. I suppose I could have died from my head injury. From a clotted vein or subdural hematoma or brain bleed. But I woke the next morning with a massive headache. Slowly walked upstairs and ate the hash browns and spam that my mother had left for me on the dining table. It was a greasy and unspoken apology. And by eating her food, I guess I had accepted it. Chapter 6 Prayer Animals. When I was 10 or 12, my late mother told me that when she was 10 or 12, she grabbed a stray cat by the front legs while her little niece grabbed its rear legs and they twisted and pulled that damned and doomed animal until it split into bloody halves. Would you be shocked to know that I wasn't shocked by that story? On the reservation, violence is a clock, ordinary and relentless, even stopped. It doesn't stop. But Jesus, As an adult in the city, I am rocked by that story's implications. My mother was not a sociopath. But animal torture is a common crime for serial killers in training. So how and why did my mother and her niece commit an act so borderline? Of course, being native females, they were bull's eyes for every man, known or unknown, indigenous or white. So which men hurt my mother and her niece so terribly and so often that they would possess the need to capture, torture, and murder something so weak? How disconnected was my mother from her body and her emotions? To survive, she had to be as mean as those who would do her harm. So I guess I know why she was often distant, storm-hearted, and cold. But my reluctant compassion does nothing to console me. As a middle-aged man who remembers, in whole, the day an older and larger white boy named Mike cajoled five of us Indian boys into his trailer for some fun. At first, he let each of us marvel at his new pellet gun. And then he shot Gooch in the neck. There was blood. It still felt ordinary, though. After all, we were young and dumb. We laughed at Gooch. We didn't run. And then Mike shot Gooch in the ear. He screamed in pain, so Mike kicked him quiet. Gooch was weak. But then Mike shot all of us. He shot me. Terrified, we did not fight. We gave up so easily as Mike roped us together into one fragile body. I'd guess I was pellet shot at least five times. Punched in the face once. Kicked in the balls twice. Mike struck matches and flicked them at our eyes. And then he pulled out a huge hunting knife and made us beg for our useless little lives. After hours of this, we escaped when I broke through a window and ran. Everybody ran without rhyme or reason. The five of us fled in five separate directions. I ran home and immediately told my mother what had just happened. And she did nothing. Oh, she said to me, Mike was joking. You take everything so seriously. My mother, so traumatized by her own painful life, could not see the sharp danger of anybody else's knife. I don't know if the other boys were as traumatized as me. They've never talked about Mike. So maybe they are mute with post-traumatic stress. Maybe they don't know how to talk about Mike. I often wonder why I'm the one who remembers all the pain. Why am I the one who remains obsessed by the bloody noise, but rarely remembers any joy? 8 years after our faux kidnapping, I was watching TV with my girlfriend when Mike's face appeared on screen. He'd been arrested in Spokane for kidnapping, raping, and murdering two little girls. One of their bodies has never been found. And then he tried to hide his crime by piling brush on the other girl's body and setting her aflame. After seeing this news, I turned to my girlfriend and said, "We were practice for him. We were dress rehearsal for rape and torture and murder. We were his game." Growing up on the res, I'd often felt like a prey animal, like a carnivore's easiest meal. But that fear was more metaphor than real. Except for the time, only a mile from my house, when a killer played with me like I was his mouse. I called my mother and asked her if she'd heard about Mike, about the murders he had committed. She said she'd forgotten about him, which meant that she'd forgotten about what he had done to me and the other Indian boys. "Mom," I said, Mike hurt us. Don't you remember that? She denied that it had ever happened, and that if it had happened, then it could not have been that bad. If Mike had done that to you for real, she said, then he would have been in trouble. He would have gone to jail. I laughed. Mom, I said, nothing happened because you didn't take me seriously. Well, my mother said, he's in jail now. So what's done is done. I was pissed at my mother's dismissal. I hung up the phone and remembered yet again that she, as a child, had once tortured, killed, and mutilated a cat. Who does shit like that? Who can be that cruel? It was my mother. That's who. Chapter 7. Benediction. I only spent a few hours with my mother as she lay dying in her rented hospital bed. I kissed her, told her I loved her, and then I fled. Chapter 8. My Sister's Waltz. Our mother was on her deathbed, dreaming more fiend dreams, speaking the tribal language in her sleep. And then she was awake, and she was thirsty. So she called out in English to my sister. Help me, she said. My mouth is dry. Using a bendy straw and a plastic cup, my sister tried to give our mother a sip of water. But my sister wasn't wearing her glasses, so her depth perception was off, and she was exhausted, so she accidentally spilled the water on Mom. Oh no, my sister said to our mother, you're soaked now. Our mother was too high on painkillers to care, but my sober sister was mortified. For perhaps the 10th time that day, she cried. Here, Mom, my sister said. Let me help you into your wheelchair, and then I can change your sheets first, and then I can change your clothes. My sister and our mother had traded maternal responsibilities. Lift your arms, my sister said. Now lift you. My sister carefully pulled our mother to her feet and wrapped her in a hug. Okay, my sister said. Now, two steps forward, and then we'll sit in your chair. Ah, the slow-motion choreography of hospice ballet. Okay, Mom, my sister said. Take one step forward. Our dying mother took that one step toward her wheelchair, but then she immediately took a step back. Our mother swayed. Mom, let me help you, my sister said. It's okay, our mother said. I'm dancing on purpose. I want to dance. Dance with me. It was 3 a.m, but our mother was awake, and she shuffled left and right. Oh, our mother said, we are dancing. It's been so long since I danced, and I don't know why nobody asked me. I was a good dancer. My sister laughed. She was alone in the night with our mother. There was no music, but my sister held our mother closely and shuffled with her. They moved in the smallest of circles. We only danced for a few seconds, my sister later said. But all that next day, whenever she was awake and had visitors, Mom kept bragging that she danced until sunrise. Oh, Mother. Oh, Mother. Even in your last moments, you told beautiful lies. Chapter 9. End of Life. My mother was a tiny woman, just under 5 feet tall. But her mother, Etta Adams, was over 6 feet tall. Her matriarchal power matched her physical size, so everybody called her Big Mom. She was born in 1904 in Nespelem, Washington, and she and her parents were close friends with the Nez Perce leader Chief Joseph and his family. Yes, my grandmother was babysat by the famous Chief Joseph, who in 1877 led his 700 followers on an epic 1,100-mile flight from 2,000 U.S. cavalry soldiers. He was eventually captured and delivered his mournful promise that he would fight no more forever. He and his followers were exiled to the Colville Indian Reservation, where Joseph died not long after my grandmother was born. For Indians, loneliness is a natural cause of death. In 1980, as she lay dying of lung cancer in her reservation home, Big Mom was visited daily by many Indians. She was famous in the Indian world for her spiritual power, for her ancient stories and songs. We still have a dozen photo albums of Big Mom, thin and bald from chemotherapy, posing with all of her indigenous visitors. My grandmother wanted to say goodbye to everybody. As she died, she wanted to be celebrated for her life. She wanted to be remembered. In 2015, as my mother lay dying of cancer in her reservation home, she asked my sisters to tell only her most trusted friends and relatives. "I don't want to see people I don't want to see," my mother said. So while my grandmother was visited by hundreds of Indians, my mother said her official goodbyes to maybe only 30 people. Most folks on the reservation didn't know she was terminally ill. My mother was a spy who treated her own death like a top-secret mission. Or maybe she was like a mad queen who believed only a few of her most loyal subjects deserved to know about her cancer. Or maybe she was terrified. Or maybe, as my wife thinks, my mother just wanted to leave this complicated world in the most uncomplicated way possible. When I visited my mother for the last time, along with my wife and teenage sons, she asked for a photograph. "Oh," my sister said, "do you want to pose with Junior's family?" "No," my mother said, "I just want a picture of Arnold and Junior and my grandsons, all the men. Put them right there." She pointed at the plasma television located only 3 feet from her rented hospital bed. "Don't you want to be in the picture with the men?" my sister asked my mother. "No, no," she said, "just them." So yes, there exists a photograph of my big brother, my sons and I, as we stand with our arms around one another in front of my late mother's big television that happened to be playing the reality show Naked and Afraid. Death is always incongruous. In that photo, you can see the foot of my mother's deathbed, but you don't see my mother. She is located outside the frame. She is the unseen witness. She exists in that negative space. Chapter 10, Valediction. After my sisters told me they had to contort themselves and my terminally ill mother as they lifted her from her deathbed and led her down the hallway into the narrow bathroom of my childhood home, then bruised her hip when they lost their grip and dropped her to the floor, I texted my big brother that he could make a greater space for everyone to navigate if he removed the bathroom door. He quickly did, as he was asked, but I should have done more than I did. I should have done something more. I've kept the score. I keep on keeping the score. When it comes to my mother's last days, I should have done more than ask my brother to fix that door. I should have done more. I should have done more. I should have bought my mother a new door, a new house, I should have bargained with the gods and given my mother a few more weeks, a few more days, a few more minutes. I should have forgiven her for all of her sins against me. I should have asked to be forgiven for my sins against her. But I never spoke of forgiveness. I only talked about the door. I only asked my brother to perform the minor work that I didn't know how to do. I made it easier for my mother to use the restroom. That's all I did. That's all I did. Jesus. I should have done more than worry about that goddamn door. I should have done more. I should have done more. But wait. What exactly should I have done? How could I have made anything better? I don't know. Not exactly. But I'm inexactly ashamed that I was, until the end, a bitter son. Chapter 11. Some prophecies are more obvious than others. Lily and Alexei died on the night of July 1st, 2015. Like our mother, my siblings and I will eventually get cancer. And some of us, maybe all of us, will be killed by that cancer. You will get sick, my wife often says to me. My wife is a Hidatsa Ho-Chunk Potawatomi Indian. The daughter of a Bureau of Indian Affairs administrator, she lived on 5 different reservations before her high school and college years in the relatively big city of Riverside, California. Therefore, she is wise and wise-ass. I know I will get cancer, I say to her. You have to be vigilant, she says. I know, I say. But how do I kill the cancer cells that probably infiltrated my body decades ago? Aren't those microscopic and domestic terrorists just waiting to strike? How do I stop the process that probably started when I took my first breath on the Spokane Indian Reservation? I cannot defeat cancer. Nobody defeats cancer. There is no winning or losing. There is no surviving or not surviving. There are only coin flips, heads or tails, benign or malignant, weight loss or bloating, morphine or oxycodone, extreme rescue efforts or do not resuscitate, live or die. Chapter 12, Terminal Velocity. Fuck you. Small cell cancer. Fuck you, fission. For splitting cells. For birthing the tumors that killed my mother. Diagnosed and dead in a few weeks, my mother was evacuated from this world like it was on fire. Fuck you, small cell cancer. For invading my mother's lungs. She was not a smoker. I want to choke you to death, small cell cancer, and suffocate you, suffocate you, suffocate you like you suffocated my mother. Fuck you, small cell cancer. I want to shoot you in the heart and mount you on the hood of my truck. I want to trophy you like you trophied my mother. Fuck you, cancer. Fuck you, cemetery dancer. I'm going to learn or invent a war anthem. A song that will obliterate you when you attack. Note by note, my song will kill you, atom by atom. My song will protect cousins, nieces, nephews, sisters, and brothers. My song will protect everybody's fathers and mothers. Fuck you. Fuck you. Fuck you, cancer, for making me wish that I could write a song powerful enough to banish you. Fuck you, God of cancer, for killing my mother, for splitting her into many halves, for turning her blood and body into host. Fuck you, small cell cancer. Fuck you, Mr. Death, for making me so grateful to be alive, for making me count and write odes to each breath. Fuck you, cancer, for being as constant as gravity, for being as necessary as food, shelter, and warmth. Fuck you. Fuck you, cancer. Fuck you for your immortality. Chapter 13. Who died on the 1st of July? Great American actor turned recluse Marlon Brando died of respiratory failure. After 20 years in exile, Juan Perón died of a heart attack 1 year into his return to power. Wilhelm Bach, composer and eldest son of Johann Sebastian Bach, never lived up to his father's fame and genius and died in poverty. Wolfman Jack, disc jockey and rock and roll pioneer, died only moments after he returned home from work and kissed his wife. Oliver Plunkett, Irish saint, was hanged, drawn, and quartered because of his faith. Harriet Beecher Stowe, abolitionist and author of Uncle Tom's Cabin, the novel that, according to some, was the first shot fired in the Civil War, died of natural causes. Nostradamus, a doctor who believed that he could see the future, though I don't know if he predicted his own death. Luther Vandross, the tenor of the gods, was only 54 years old when he died of diabetes and heart failure. Lillian Alexi, my mother, died of small cell cancer in a hospital bed at her reservation home. She'd wanted to die on the living room couch where she'd slept for nearly 40 years. It wasn't the same couch all that time. 5 previous couches died before my mother did. She is survived by the living and the ghosts of her tribe. To honor her legacy, light a fire, so that you smell like powwow campground smoke. In lieu of flowers, please donate your time to quilt work, basketball, and dirty jokes. Chapter 14. Drive, she said. Traveling 296 miles to my mother's wake and funeral, my wife and sons and I drive past 5 roadkill deer, 2 squashed coyotes, and a porcupine roughly ripped in half. In another time, if my mother had been a passenger, she'd have insisted that we pull over the car and park so she could carefully collect that porcupine and take it home to harvest the sharp quills for war dance regalia. But my mother is dead, and my wife and sons and I don't war dance. So we drive past that dead porcupine and abandon its ceremonial possibilities. But I know for the rest of my life I will think of my mother and her knife and the dozens of times she gave extraordinary meaning to ordinary porcupines and their quills. Ah, listen closely when you drive along a 2-lane highway between the pines, and you'll hear 100 war dancers rattling their now human quills and thanking my mother, thanking my mother, thanking my mother for her beauty and will. Chapter 15. The Viewing. As the story goes, my beautiful cousin was born with deer legs, dropped from the womb and sprinted out of the clinic and made it halfway home before the tribal cops pulled her over for speeding. In kindergarten, she was faster than every adult. I watched her, 3 feet tall, outrace my father up a sandhill while dodging rattlesnakes at Blue Creek. In 6th grade, Racing in her first organized meet, she looked back near the finish line and was so far ahead that she burst into tears because she'd hurt her opponent's feelings. And then she never raced again. In 2015, a few days after my mother's death, my quick cousin stood next to me as I stared at my dead mother lying in her plain pine coffin at the funeral home in Spokane. The undertakers were white men, but they'd buried generations of local Indians, so they knew how to culturally comfort us, and better, they knew how to leave us alone. That was the private family and friends viewing. So that meant 30 loud Indians had gathered in the otherwise quiet funeral home. "Lillian looks beautiful," my cousin said, and I had to agree. My mother wore her favorite turquoise business suit and a multicolored beaded medallion that could have eclipsed the sun or moon. My cousin took my hand, bumped me with her hip, and said, "Hey, you and I used to be the skinny and pretty cousins, and now we're old and fat and homely." "Hey," I said, "I'm still pretty from the neck up." My cousin laughed and said, "My soul's spirit animal is the butterfly, but my ass's spirit animal is the buffalo." And I said, "I eat food like my father used to drink booze. I binge and binge." And my cousin said, "Oh man, me too." And then my cousin began to weep. I didn't cry with her, but I mourned. I don't know if I was mourning my mother, or if I was mourning for myself, or if I was mourning for my cousin's mourning. Maybe I was mourning everything. "Nothing makes me hungrier than sadness," I said. I could eat a TV dinner made out of apple strudel, Salisbury steak, carrots, and grief. My cousin smiled. We hugged and shared a half-lipped cousinly kiss, then ambled over to the waiting room, where my eternal cousin reached into her tote bag and pulled out a bag of nacho cheese tortilla chips like it was a relic worthy of worship, like we just returned from an ancient vault where the dead worshipped only crunch and salt. My cousin and I ate all those chips. We ate the walls and floors. We ate all of the coffins, jewelry, and shawls. We ate all of the flowers, and we ate all of the air. Then, for dessert, we ate all of the prayers. Chapter 16. Everything Costs. Sitting in the funeral home, with my mother's body lying in view in another room only 20 feet away, I paid for her coffin and burial and transportation with a credit card. I had enough cash to pay for all the expenses, but I wanted to collect the Alaska Airlines miles. The bureaucracy of death. The sacredness of death. The sacredness of bureaucracy. The beauty of frequent flyer miles. "Did you know my mother?" I asked the white undertaker, and yes, of course he did. "I talked to Lillian at many wakes and funerals," the undertaker said. "She was a funny person." I'd been to 20 or 30 funerals on my reservation, but I realized that the undertaker had probably been to 100 or more. He'd buried so many of my fellow tribal members. No matter how much you think you know about death, there is always somebody else who knows more. As I signed the funeral home contracts, I thought about the last time I had talked to my mother. The last time I talked to her before she had become seriously and then terminally ill. Before she'd gotten sick, I had not seen or emailed or texted or spoken to my mother for, I don't know, 3 or 5 months. After all of that silence on my part, Not exactly intentional, but not at all surprising. She called and left a weeping message on my phone. "Junior," she said, "I know you blame me for everything, but please, talk to me." A week later, I called. "What's happening on the res?" I asked. I didn't ask her about the weepy message she'd left. I didn't want to encourage her dramatics. I knew her tears had been lures. "Oh," she said, "we had a funeral yesterday." "Who died?" She said the name. I remembered him. An old Indian guy who used to work forestry. I knew him better 30 years ago. I knew his kids 20 years ago. Didn't know his grandkids at all. "How'd he die?" I asked. "Heart attack." I remembered when my mother used to cook for almost every funeral and wake on the reservation. Some other folks took over that responsibility after my mother got too old. "That other family cooks now, right?" I asked my mother. "Instead of you?" "Yeah," she said. "They'll cook for my wake and funeral when I die."
"That'll be weird," I said. "They hate me."
"That's okay. They love your brothers and sisters." I laughed. "And besides," she said, "they'll feed you good anyway. You know that's how it works." The unwritten rules of tribalism, the inherent responsibilities, the silent acceptance of duty, the endless social legacy of a people who've spent most of their existence living at a subsistence level. Taking care of one is taking care of the many. And vice versa. "Remember that time in high school," I asked my mother, "when I slid on ice and drove into the ditch?" "Which time?" my mother asked. Another truth. If you live in a wintry climate and are too poor to afford good tires, then you will often hit the ditch, hopefully at low speeds. "That time by the dump," I said, "when I was daydreaming about winning the lottery and just spaced out." "All right," my mother said. "That's when your cousin pulled you out. You were lucky he showed up." My cousin did rescue me, and I was grateful to him. But he disliked me so much that he never said a word as he stopped his truck, grabbed a rope out of the back, tied one end to his rig and one end to mine, and pulled me out of the snow. And then he continued to ignore me as he untied the rope, got back in his truck, and drove away. I am greatly amused by the white folks who believe that being Indian means you automatically fit like a puzzle piece into the jigsaw of your family and tribe. I'm even more amused by the Indians who believe that, too. "Is there anything else you need?" I asked my mother on the phone. I wanted to hang up. I couldn't handle too much time talking to her. I needed to reclaim my separation from her. "Can you send some money?" she said. "I spent my Social Security on the cable bill and the electricity." "I'll send a check," I said. "Don't forget," she said. "I won't forget." "Yes, you will." I did forget for a week. Then my mother left another message on my phone. "Junior," she said, "we need firewood." Except the message was garbled. So I thought she said, "Junior, she breathes fire good." So imagine my disappointment when I discovered the truth. "Oh man," I said to my wife, "I thought maybe some woman named She Breathes Fire Good had moved to the res. That sounds like a Montana Indian name, right? Like maybe a new Crow Indian woman doctor started working at the clinic. Dr. She Breathes Fire Good. That name rocks. I'm going to write a new short story about a Crow doctor named that. It'll be awesome. I haven't yet written that short story. I often have ideas for stories I know that I will never write. But there is a good story in everything. My mother died of lung cancer, even though she had not smoked a cigarette in 40 years. So let me now imagine Dr. She breathes fire good. Let me imagine she somehow diagnoses my mother when the cancer is only one split cell. Let me imagine that Dr. She breathes fire good gave my mother another 5 years of life, another 10, another 20. Let me imagine my 100-year-old mother leaving a message for the 70-year-old me. Junior, she says into the machine, you better call me. I could die at any second. Mom, I say back, I'm an old Indian man. Chances are good I will die before you do. But of course, my mother died first. And my father is dead too. And based on health statistics and lifestyles, I would bet that I'm going to outlive my reservation-based siblings as well. It's a morbid thought, but it's not inaccurate. Dear brothers, dear sisters, if you die before me, then I will pay to put you in the ground. I will bury you near our parents. And once or twice a year, I will lug my old and battered self to your collective grave and apologize for winning the final spin of the Alexei family terminal cancer roulette wheel. Chapter 17, Reviewing. In the funeral home, I told my sister that my mother looked better than she had in years. Better than she had since our father had died 12 years earlier. The undertaker did a great job with her makeup, I said. He didn't make her look pretty, my sister said. I did that. Wow, I said. What did that feel like? I felt like a little girl, she said. Like Mom was teaching me how to put on makeup again. I don't remember her teaching you that, I said. Why would you remember that? She asked. It just seems like a normal thing for a mother to teach a daughter, I said, and Mom rarely did normal things. Well, my sister said, Mom taught us how to put on makeup by making us practice on Dad. What? I asked and laughed. You put makeup on Dad? Yeah, my sister said. Lipstick, eyeshadow, blush, and everything. No way, I said. I don't believe you. It's true. Dad was okay with that, I asked. He didn't say anything, my sister said, but I think he wished he looked prettier in makeup. What? I said and laughed even harder. Yeah, my sister said. This one time, he stared at his face in the mirror and said, all that work, and I still look like myself. That's so funny, I said. Maybe Mom and Dad are doing each other's makeup in heaven. That would be beautiful, my sister said. And silly. If heaven ain't filled with gender-swapping Indians, I said, then I don't want to go there. Chapter 18. Scatological. After everybody else left the funeral home, after our closest friends and family had said their private goodbyes to my mother, I stayed behind to use the restroom. As I squatted on the old toilet, I wept for the first time since my mother died. And then I shat. I wept and shat. And yes, I am famously gifted as a weeper and a shitter. My Alcoholics Anonymous friend, who remains nameless, of course, as do many other folks in this book, calls me Thunder Tears. My siblings call me Dairy Queen because I have always filled up toilets like a human soft-serve ice cream machine. Well, on that grief-stricken day, as my mother's body lay only two walls away, I took the largest shit of my life. I expelled everything. After I was done, I stood and looked at that shit cobra floating in the toilet, and I said aloud, I'm gonna need Ricky Tikki Tavi to kill that thing. And then I noticed the handwritten sign on the wall above the toilet. Please be gentle with our toilet. The pipes are old. Be judicious in your use of toilet paper. I was impressed with the Undertaker's vocabulary.